Okay, so I guess we should get started. Started talking about particle physics, actually, the structure of matter and forces last time. And there is this... So there's a lot of different names and particles and things that you probably may not have heard of before, which I'll be throwing at you. I'll try to sort of paint a picture of how it all fits together, but you'd probably be an unusual person if it felt warm and fuzzy at the end of the day. The picture that we use in particle physics or in modern physics and quantum mechanics to describe forces is the theory is called quantum field theory, and it really operates by the uncertainty in quantum mechanics that effectively says that over short periods of time you have a lot of uncertainty on really the structure of something, and that all of those possibilities that could happen have to be taken into account if you want to understand something like a particle. So you get lots of different possibilities for what a particle could be actually over a short period of time. It might not be just a particle, it might actually pair produce into lots of other things, including particles that are massively heavy, much heavier than the particle itself, effectively breaking conservation of energy as long as it does it over a very short time. And if you have such a picture of particles and you're trying to model a force between two particles, if you exchange one of these so-called virtual possibilities, one of these virtual particles, so say we have a particle here that's at the moment is sort of like these virtual possibilities and another one of these, if one of these particles gets exchanged, it can actually be an exchange of momentum, and that is how you... That's sort of the mathematical model of the nature of a force. And the specifics of the type of force you have between the particles is dependent on what the particle is that gets exchanged in this picture. So it's very much like people on ice throwing a ball back and forth, basically exerting a force between one another. So typically we talk about four different fundamental forces in nature. If we go and we look at anything fundamental, you can talk about the force of friction, but that's not really a fundamental force, because that's a force between two surfaces rubbing against each other. If you look at it, it's really a force between pieces of one surface rubbing against pieces of the other surface, and in the end what's holding them together is really slight electric adhesion, or the fact that one surface actually sticks out and the other, so they're coming together unevenly and catching on one another, but that is actually electromagnetic in form, because that's what's holding together the parts of the surface. So if we ask what are the fundamental interactions between particles, there are four different forces that we know about. One is gravitation, and only particles with mass interact gravitationally. Its range is infinite, but it's an extraordinarily weak force relative to the other forces. The force of electromagnetism, we've talked a lot about. Particles that feel the force of electromagnetism basically have to have electric charge. Neutral particles don't feel it, except that the photon itself does, because it's the particle that gets exchanged between the other particles to transmit the force. The strong nuclear force that I'll talk about in a little while, but it has a very, very short range. And remember, we talked about the fact that whatever it is that holds the nucleus together has to have a range that's really small, because if you're sending charged particles through material, they scatter off of nuclei as if all they see is the Coulomb force or the force of electromagnetism until they get to within about 10 to the minus 15 meters, and then something weird will happen. You have something different happening, and that's because all of a sudden at that range they begin to feel the strong nuclear force. And then there's something called the weak nuclear force, which has an even shorter range, and it's actually responsible for beta decay. So I'll talk about let me just move on and try to make some sense out of some of this. So those are the basic forces. We also have to have players that can that feel the forces, and there are three types of fundamental categories of particles, we believe. One set of particles are... How did I do that? Everything went off, but the lights I was wanting to make go off. Okay. In fact, maybe try this. Is that better? So one set of particles are called quarks. One set of particles are called leptons, and another set of particles, they say force carriers here, but we typically call them gauge bosons. And these names sound ridiculous. There are stories behind them, and I guess I'm not going to take time to tell you a lot of the history. There's a bit of it in, I think it's chapter 5 that I'm asking you to read this week. There is some of the history of the discovery of some of these particles and why we believe in this particular picture of the universe. Some of these things are familiar. The electron is now a very familiar particle. The photon is a very familiar particle. It is actually if a photon is exchanged between two particles, that is the force of electromagnetism in quantum field theory. If a gluon is exchanged, that's the strong nuclear force. If the Z or the W are exchanged, it's called the weak force. These particles are known as neutrinos, and these particles are bizarre beasts. They happen to have fractional electric charge. These have a charge of +1 or -1. The muon is nothing more than a fat electron. I mean, we see them in nature. They have a mass of about 2,000 times the electron, but other than that, they look just like an electron. The tau is the same sort of thing, but even heavier. Neutrinos have extremely small masses. We have yet to even actually measure the masses of the neutrinos, and they're sort of bizarre beasts. I don't know that I'll talk a whole lot about them. The Z is very similar to the photon, except it's got a mass that's about the same as 100 protons. It's a very heavy fundamental particle. And the W is similar to the Z, except it has charge. So there are lots of different particles. And so how do these things hang together? Well, this brings me to a different topic. Sorry. I'll get back to the spectrum of particles in a minute and how they fit together. All of the particles that we know of in nature actually also have antiparticles, which may sound sort of strange, but there's a symmetry in nature between matter and antimatter. And if you think about it, if you have an energy fluctuation in a vacuum and you have enough energy there that by E equals mc squared, you could form massive particles. If you have to conserve charge, then you can't just form one particle. You would have to form a particle with opposite charges. So, for example, you might form an electron and its antiparticle, a positron, but you're not just going to form the electron out of nothing because electric charge is conserved. Yeah.
Aren't there neutral particles?
Yeah, there are neutral particles, and it turns out they also have antiparticles, even though...
Think of a neutral particle. What's opposite about the antiparticle?
There are other quantum numbers, the other characteristics that change. Primarily, you think of the charge, but there are other characteristics that change. Yeah. Yeah, conservation of electric charge holds true even in this weird virtual picture and quantum mechanics and stuff. It's conservation of energy, in fact, holds true, but you have the caveat that within the uncertainty principle, you've got latitude in that things can only happen under a short time. So I say loosely that conservation of energy is broken, but that's sort of a loose usage of it because it helps us visualize it. But in fact, that whole thing doesn't happen very often. If you want to see one of those particles that's in the virtual cloud, you literally have to put in enough energy to kick it out and make it real. It's not real in a sense. It's
okay. But charge is always kept.
But within the mathematics where you're considering all these particles, you always conserve charge and momentum.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was that big boson the Higgs boson? The one that had 100
The Z and the W. No, those are not Higgs. I'll talk about the Higgs, but I'm not there yet. The Higgs is. We talked a little bit about spin, right? So particles with half integral spin are called fermions. Particles with integral spin are called bosons. And these were so-called gauge bosons, which means they're the ones that actually mediate the forces. The Higgs boson is a boson, but where it fits in, I'll talk about, but it doesn't carry a force. So it turns out that the quarks have fractional charges, and the picture is that quarks combine into other particles that are more familiar to you, like the proton or the neutron. So, for example, two up quarks, each of which have a charge of +2/3, will combine with a down quark, which has a charge of -1/3, to create a particle that has a charge of +1, and that is a proton. So the proton, if you scatter particles off of it, you actually find that it has evidence that there's substructure inside it. And in fact, Ari Bodek, here in the physics department, his PhD thesis was discovering that, more or less, and his advisor and two other guys won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of quarks in 1970-something. So here's your atom, and you've got the electrons out here, then you've got the protons and neutrons, but inside the protons and neutrons you have these weird particles called quarks. And so the neutron, which is neutral, is made up of two d quarks, which has which have charges of -1/3 each, and a u quark, which has a charge of +2/3. And then there are lots of other particles, some of which I'll show you. Yeah.
I have two questions.
Yep.
Would a quark be mixed with a different type of particle? Like in, composing, a neutron or something like that? Or do the quark, like, the other two, you got the leptons, I think, in one of them. Are they always, like, are quarks, or are quarks always together and, like, leptons always together?
Okay, so one of the things that is the difference between the leptons and the quarks is that quarks feel the strong interaction. They interact with gluons. So, in fact, I always hesitate to say this, whereas in electromagnetism, particles have electric charge, plus or minus, it turns out that in the theory of the strong interaction, there are three types of charge, and we call them color charge. And only quarks and gluons will feel that particular type of charge. So these are the only types of particles that can feel the strong force. And it is the strong force that binds the quarks into protons and neutrons and other types of particles. So there's a long list of them that we've discovered. Pions, kaons, lots of them that you don't normally see. They're not part of normal matter, but in accelerators we see them. But leptons don't carry color charge, so they don't interact with gluons. They don't get stuck in the nucleus, per se, because they don't feel this particular force.
And also, are they all the same size?
Well, that's a good question. Protons and neutrons, this thing is about 10 to the minus 15 meters in size. The atom is about 10 to the minus 8-ish in size. But now if you go and you ask what is the size of the quark or the size of the electron, we actually have not yet measured a size to them. And we have probed to things on the order of 10 to the minus 18 meters thereabouts. So in the LHC, one of the ways to think about it is as the particles are coming together at higher and higher energies, you're effectively probing structures that are smaller and smaller. If you recall, when we looked at the wave-particle duality for particles, we had you could calculate the wavelength of particles of a given momentum. And the higher the momentum of the particle, the shorter the wavelength. And if you have a short wavelength thing, you can resolve spatial structure. So a way to think about that is if I'm trying to image something with a photon that has a large wavelength, basically I can't bounce it off cleanly off an object that's on the order of the size of that wavelength or smaller. I don't even know what it means to sort of try to image an object when it's that. So I have to use objects or photons that have a shorter wavelength than the object I'm trying to image. So as we go up in energy, we call it the de Broglie wavelength, the quantum wavelength of the particles actually becomes smaller. So we're actually imaging things that are smaller and smaller. So to date, we currently, within our models, view quarks and leptons and the gauge bosons as fundamental particles. And we do not know, we have no evidence of substructure to them yet. There are some problems with our current models that indicate that perhaps we'll begin to see something interesting going on, for example, at LHC. This is the whole reason the LHC was built, but I'll talk about that later as we go. Yes?
Is there any way we know the proportions of that? I don't know the answer to this, but
is there any way we know quarks exist? Is that? Yeah.
The concern of the carbon sliders have to be, the question is the example that you gave last time of the cars crashing into each other.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's sort of how we know. I mean, a way to think about it is, if I throw baseballs at a car, they're sort of low energy, and they'll just bounce off the car. And if I look at how they bounce, I can sort of, how they scatter off the car, I can get an idea of the size of the car, basically. And in doing so, I will not infer that there is any structure inside the car. But if instead I'm shooting a high-powered rifle at a car, and I look at the ricochet of the bullets and use that to infer the structure, then, in fact, what I will see are things like the engine block inside the car, and I'll begin to be able to tell. So when we literally, quarks were discovered by shooting beams of electrons at targets and looking at how they scattered. And when you look at how they scattered off of targets of, say, hydrogen, at low energies, they scatter as if they are scattering off the proton itself, the full proton. And then as you go to higher energies, you begin to actually see that you're not scattering off the whole proton, but you're scattering off of a particle that seems smaller and has a charge that's actually fractional. And so this is one of the ways you infer the existence of quarks. So we don't actually see quarks for reasons I'll tell you about in a minute. We don't actually see them directly. We have to infer their existence from other particles that we see. Yes?
This is probably over my head, but I heard that quarks can actually like trade places within a nucleus lots of times per second. Is there any basis to that?
I have to think a little bit about exactly what you're getting at. I will have one picture which may make that make a little more sense. I'm not sure if it's exactly what you were thinking about, but let me try it. See if it's the next one. No, getting close. It'll be in a slide or two, so I'll mention it. Okay, so we picture forces in particle physics as the exchange of these different particles between other particles. So here, for example, are two electrons exchanging a photon, which I didn't label, but when we use this squiggly line, it means a photon. These little diagrams are things actually called Feynman diagrams. Richard Feynman came up with these. And they're really useful for trying to picture what's going on in these events. It turns out that the mathematics for calculating these types of things is really brutal. I mean, it's really nasty, long equations and everything. And it's very hard to look at the equations and tell what's going on. And Richard Feynman came up with this sort of pictograph way of looking at the different processes, where each of these symbols, actually, each of these lines, each vertex and each one of these lines, they actually count for long mathematical expression. So, in fact, to a quantum field theorist, this is really a way of looking at a mathematical calculation. So it's almost a step beyond mathematics. It's a very cool thing which Richard Feynman did. For those of us who aren't doing those types of calculations, it's just sort of pictograph, nice way of picturing these things, and can be very useful. At any rate, here's a Feynman diagram describing the electromagnetic interaction between two particles where they exchange a photon. For the weak interaction, the particle that gets exchanged is a Z or a W. The Z is neutral, the W is charged. In this case, for example, a charged electron comes along and emits a W, this is the virtual particle, that interacts with a neutrino, and the charge of the electron, the minus charge, effectively goes this route and ends up in this muon over here, and the electron turns into an electron neutrino. So this is an example of a weak interaction, and it's the kind of thing, I don't know if I have a good picture of it, but this is sort of the kind of thing that happens that causes beta decay in nuclei. Yes?
The E, is that supposed to be negative?
Yeah, the E is supposed to be negative here. The strong force is the exchange of this particle called the gluon. And the nature of the forces is dictated in part by the nature of the particles that are exchanged. So a photon, being massless, I could create a virtual photon with an infinitesimally small energy. I can basically create a photon with an extremely low energy, which means in order to create a virtual photon, I don't have to break conservation of energy by very much, which means by the uncertainty principle, if this is small, then this can be quite large, which means the virtual photon in principle can have a long range. So the electromagnetic force, for example, basically has an infinite range. In the weak interaction, the W and the Z, this is 80 protons worth of mass, this is 91 protons worth of mass. These are very massive particles. So to create a W or a Z, virtually using this Heisenberg uncertainty principle, I have to break the conservation of energy by a massive amount, because it has to be at least equal to the mass of the Z or the W. If this number is really, really, really big, then that Z or W virtually can only exist for an extraordinarily short time. Then even at the speed of light, it could only go a short distance, which means I can only exchange a Z or a W virtually over a very, very short distance, which tells you that the weak interaction has an extremely short range, which it does. It has a range of about 10 to the minus 18 meters. It's not actually weak. It just almost never happens, because two particles almost never pass that close to one another for that force to ever happen. The strong force has a limited range, but it's for a different reason, because the gluon is also massless like the photon. I think I'm saying a lot of the same stuff there. Okay, so the quarks we don't normally see in our detectors, no matter how hard we bash things together, and I'll tell you why in a minute. They combine into other particles. So three quarks combine into particles which we call generically baryons. So protons and antiprotons are baryons. And I've already mentioned how these quarks combine to form the proton. So each of these is 2/3, and that one is minus 1/3, and you end up with a charge of plus 1. And there are other types of particles here. You've probably heard of protons and neutrons, and you probably really haven't heard of most of these others. They can also form in a way where you have two of them. You have a quark and an anti-quark can form, and these are called mesons, and there are lots of types of mesons out here. And again, you don't normally have to worry about this because it's not something you see in normal atoms and stuff like this, but if you go and you start crashing particles together at high energies, you begin to see all of these weird beasts coming out. And part of what we have to do to understand the nature of forces and particles is to understand what kind of beasts and what their characteristics are. So the most common sort of meson is called a pion. These things can be neutral or not. So how do these things fit together? All right, so we've got quarks here, we've got the leptons, and we have gauge bosons. So at least in terms of how an atom goes together, quarks combine into hadrons. In particular, these two quarks are protons. I mean, these three quarks form a proton, these three quarks form a neutron, which then fit together into a nucleus, and the electromagnetic force basically binds the electron into atoms. And all of these other quarks, these quarks and these leptons, and even typically here, you don't normally see in everyday life. Okay, so it's, and we've got lots of strange new names. They're not as ridiculous as they sound, although, okay, so this is the up quark, the down quark, the charm quark, the strange quark, the top quark, and the bottom quark. There's reasons for it. I don't know if I want to drag you through any of that. Hadrons, baryon, mesons. This is heavyweight in Greek, and this is middleweight in Greek, and lepton is lightweight in Greek. So there's some reason for some of these things. So when we first started discovering things, you know, protons are very massive, electrons are very light. So an electron is a lepton, and protons, a baryon, Yeah, and then there are intermediate mass particles, which are the mesons. And then we sort of historically get stuck with the names, and then as we begin to figure out what we think these things really are, then we form the categories around those names. And so that's how you get all these strange names. So the strong force is an interesting force in that it has a very limited range, and it turns out that no matter how hard I kick a particle that contains quarks, I cannot blast a free quark out and see it. So no matter how hard we look in a detector, we've never seen a particle that has this fractional electric charge, which is something that you can actually see pretty nicely in detectors. And the reason for this is in the strong force, it's very different relative to other forces. If I have two charged particles, electrically charged particles, and I try to pull them apart, as I bring them apart further and further, the force between them becomes weaker. It falls off as 1 over r squared, basically, right? In the strong force, it's flipped. It may sound a little bit weird, but if I take two particles that have color charge and I try to pull them apart, the force between them actually grows. It becomes stronger and harder. It becomes harder and harder to pull them further and further. So what happens is that so as you bring them further apart, the strength of the force actually increases. And you'll reach a point where the strength is so strong that something really bizarre happens. So here, for example, is basically, you think of it as a proton, and I call it a white proton because color charges, we have three different types, and so we call them red, blue, and green. And you can have a bound state, which is colorless, if you form a particle of the red, blue, and green and mix them together, sort of like light. In fact, the theory of this is called quantum chromodynamics. The quantum theory of electromagnetism is called quantum electrodynamics. Here, this is based on color charge, has nothing to do with real colors. It's just sort of this analogy that people use. And so they call it quantum chromodynamics. So the quantum theory of electromagnetism is called quantum electrodynamics, QED, and this is quantum chromodynamics, or QCD. At any rate, so this is a particle that is a bound state that has no color because I've mixed together all three colors here. So like light, you mix together the different colored light and you get a colorless state. And now if we do an experiment where we where we go and we try to bash the proton really, really hard and look at particles coming out, then in fact we can kick the proton pretty hard. We can bash a quark and knock it out of a proton. But when we do, what happens is this force between these particles becomes stronger and stronger. And eventually the energy density that is in the space between these particles because of this force growing is so great that you can form a particle and antiparticle pair. The energy effectively is equal to the mass of the particle and antiparticle, quark and a quark, antiquark, and what you get is a particle here, like a meson that has a color and an anticolor, and a proton that has the three colors again. So when you kick a particle made of quarks and you break it apart, basically it pulls other quarks out of the vacuum and you end up with a bunch of free particles, none of which are free quarks. They're protons and neutrons and pions and stuff. So you end up with the jets of other particles coming out. It's sort of a strange thing. But that is why the strong force has a limited range, actually. Yes?
This may be an unrealistic question, but is there a vacuum that has no matter and antimatter besides a proton, and then you pull it apart and you get the force so great?
I mean, vacuum, quantum fluctuations are everywhere. So a vacuum, you mean nothing, but you can't have nothing in the quantum world because... So you can't have that, yeah. Just as a bit of an aside, and maybe this is what gets at the question you had a moment ago, the force that actually binds the protons and neutrons in a nucleus together, actually you don't think of as the exchange of quarks. The quarks are, the gluons are what's holding the protons and the neutrons together in a sense. But if you exchange quarks sort of in this weird sort of way and effectively exchange pions, which are a mix of the quark and anti-quark like that, that is actually the strong force that holds the nucleons together in a nucleus. So it's a slightly different take. Fundamentally, it is the strong interaction at work, but what you see is it's really the exchange of these quarks. And so in that sense, inside the nucleus, you have this seething mass of protons and neutrons that are sort of constantly exchanging these virtual pions, or you can think of it as an exchange of two quarks going back and forth, where the quarks are always bound together by this strong force. So it's a bit of a mess.
Yeah.
So. Okay, so there are lots of fundamental processes that we use this picture to describe. And example here is beta decay. Inside a nucleus, if a neutron turns into a proton and an electron antineutrino that come out, then what you would see is this, basically this electron coming out, the proton would stay in the nucleus and an electron neutrino comes out. But turns out that electron neutrinos, neutrinos only interact via the weak interaction. They don't have electric charge. They don't have color charge. And it means neutrinos can actually go through matter without interacting most of the time. Very seldom will a neutrino interact with matter. If I take this neutrino and I have a neutrino gun and I shoot it, it could go through something like hundreds of light years of lead without interacting. I mean, that's the kind of thing. So to ever see neutrinos, which we have seen in the lab, we really need vast numbers of them, because most of them will just go right through your detector, but once in a while one will interact. At any rate, in beta decay, inside the nucleus, what will happen is that one of the d quarks will turn into a u quark. But the charge is different, right? The D is plus 2/3 and the U is minus 1/3. So for this D to change into a U, it has to give up a charge. And so if it emits a virtual W, which then decays into an electron and an electron neutrino, then you're stuck with this conversion, and so you go from a DDU, which is a neutron, to a UUD, which is a proton. So inside the nucleus, the neutron decays to a proton, and you emit this electron, and you can now calculate this rate in quantum field theory and understand the process very well. Yes?
Can you slow down?
No, no, it's okay. But yeah, that's a real question, because if I slow down much and really start explaining this stuff, well, we're going to end up doing an entire course on it, and I don't want to emphasize it that much. I'm just trying to sort of give you some flavor to it. I understand that I am shoving... I understand you're taking a sip from a fire hydrant right now. I am doing that to you. I'm not expecting all of this to stick.
So what is supposed to stick?
I'm going to sort of summarize the pieces a little further on, and I'll try to give you a feeling for it. I'm not expecting you to do a lot of this. I'm trying to give you a flavor of it, if that makes any sense.
So we just need to, like, know that it exists?
Yeah, I'll try to, through the recitation and through the summaries that I'm going to try to do, I'll try to give you a better feeling for what I'm hoping you're actually getting out of it. It is complicated enough. I mean, even just with the language, there are all these different names, and it is hard. I mean, I understand, you know, it's a lot at once, so it doesn't make warm and fuzzy sense. But I don't know how to do it other than to try to sort of show you the basic framework and just get you used to the idea a little bit and the terms. And then as we move into the stuff that's more core to the course, like... what happens in the evolution of the Big Bang, and I start talking about some of these fundamental particles, they're not a surprise at that point. But the exact characteristics of them is not actually so important to you. I am going to spend a little bit more time to try to give you a flavor of what we actually think we understand and where this stuff breaks down. So let me continue blasting you for a little while, and then I'll try slowing down, and then we can talk more. But let me if I slow down too much, it's part of the problem is I can't make any of this make sense till I sort of try to throw the framework out there and we do some of the pieces. It's a struggle. This whole topic of particle physics, I found, is always a bit of a struggle to talk about. So we've actually already talked about this, that the vacuum isn't the vacuum. It's actually these little pairs of particles and antiparticle pairs that pop in and out of things. And that's a bit of a theme that we're going to be looking at in cosmology as we go. All right, so the actual theory that we are talking about, we call the Standard Model of Particle Physics. And this theory came about in the 1970s, and one of the guys who invented a piece of it is Peter Higgs, and we'll talk a bit about a particle that's named after him. There are other guys. Nobel Prizes have been given for this. In fact, a Nobel Prize was given to people just a couple of years ago for a piece of it, but I didn't get their pictures up on the slides, I don't think. We actually do have a local connection to this. I'm going to talk about something which I'll call the Higgs mechanism, which is the theoretical thing that makes this whole model work. And it's called the Higgs mechanism, but there were actually six people involved in making it work. And two of them were here at U of R, one of whom is still here at U of R. You may see him floating around, Professor Hagen. And just last year, in fact, he was one of the member of the six that got a very nice American award, not quite a Nobel Prize, but sort of the American Physical Society's highest award for this stuff. So what is this theory? In the early years when things were being developed, people understood electromagnetism very nicely through Maxwell's equations, and then they created a theory using this quantum field theory idea of exchanging virtual photons. That's known as quantum electrodynamics, and that worked pretty well to describe purely electromagnetic things. Similarly, people could understand, using the idea of the exchange of a heavy particle like a Z or a W, although they didn't call them that at the time, they could understand the characteristics of things like beta decay, and they called it the weak interaction. So we had, at the time, basically two working theories that seemed okay, but they actually had a very fundamental problem, that there was a, that there were requirements in the mathematics of the theory that kept, that required the particles to be exchanging, the virtual particles, to actually have no mass. So, oddly enough, they could sort of explain the characteristics of electromagnetism, but only in the limit that the, say, the electrons that are exchanging this photon have no mass. So, it's sort of useful, but also clearly not quite the right answer. So in the 1970s, people came up with a way of actually fixing this problem. They discovered that if they added a different particle, one that we have never seen before but had particular characteristics, which they call the Higgs boson, and they basically would take this theory and that theory, write them both down on a piece of paper, and add an additional particle in the theory, and then basically mix up the terms, and there was some magic to how they do the mixing of the terms mathematically, having to choose particular symmetries in the problem. And so you can imagine sitting down at a dinner table and the water glasses are set like this, and a person sitting here, 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 and here. Somebody's got to decide, are they going to drink out of that water glass or that water glass? And once they do, everybody else goes to the same side. So you can have a theory where there's a symmetry exhibited by the mathematics, and that you have to make some choices. And so they do that, which goes under the catchword of spontaneous symmetry breaking. But it turns out that when you take these not quite right theories and you put them together into one framework and you add this ad hoc particle called the Higgs, which nobody's ever seen before, and you play games with the mathematics, it turns out that you can get a theory that, one, allows for mass terms for the particles, so all of a sudden it becomes much more realistic in nature because particles do have mass, and it actually predicts the existence of the W and Z with very particular properties. Okay, and this happened in the 1970s. In the 1980s, people went and looked, and in colliders, they actually discovered the Z and the W and found them to have exactly the properties predicted by this theory. So this is what we really know of as the standard model of particle physics. And it has very particular predictions, which have been seen in lab in many experiments to very high precision. So we think this theory is true insofar as it goes. The funny thing is, though, this theory only works because we add a particle into the mix of particles that we know exist that we've never seen before, which is called the Higgs. Okay, and so because the model works so well, we know there must be something in nature that does within the model what the Higgs does, but we don't know what that is. But we do have indications as to what energy range this type of thing ought to happen, and this is what dictates the energy for the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. And one of the primary reasons that collider was built at great expense was to see if we could figure out whether there is a fundamental Higgs particle or find something that basically would act like the Higgs in a model. And there are lots of ideas that would actually do what the Higgs does within the model. But so it's a way of going into new, trying to discover new physics, basically, is once we figure out what the Higgs does, then we may discover new things about the universe. Yeah. So with quarks, we think we understand why we don't see them, and we do see the residual nature of them. So if I kick a proton really hard, it is true I don't see the basic quarks coming out, but I do see jets of particles, and the characteristics of those other particles and how those are distributed and everything can basically tell me that it's consistent with scattering off of particles that have the characteristics of quarks. So we do. There's a whole lot of indirect, very strong indirect evidence that quarks are actually there. So we do believe in those. The Higgs, nobody's seen any indirect evidence. The only evidence we have of the existence of the Higgs is the fact that the Standard Model seems to work so well, and that's the only way we know to make it work. Yes?
The symmetry that you talked about on the last slide, the place settings, you were trying to get across that all of those things happen at once, and so it's not...
That I was really just trying to get across that there is a reason why we pay the theorists to do what they do. They have to actually manipulate the mathematics to make it work. And there is a... there's some language they use to describe what they do, which is called spontaneous symmetry breaking. And so I was really just trying to sort of explain that in case you ever hear it called that, or whether Hobson talks about it. It's not really that relevant for what we're doing. There's a symmetry within the mathematics that they make choices in order to pull out the solution that seems to actually describe the universe we live in. Yeah.
So the Higgs is supposed to prove the mass of the equation, so it kind of proves...
The Higgs allows mass terms to exist in the theory.
Right.
And so some people say that the Higgs is responsible for mass.
Yeah.
There's a connection there. I think there's a deeper... I would argue there are other things that can lead to mass, so that's not the only piece, but I don't want to get into it.
Yeah, because I had a friend who said that gravity might be higher dimensional entropy.
Ooh. Okay, you got me on thin ice there. We're going to get into general relativity shortly and discover there's a deep relationship between gravity and the nature of space and time. So we will get into that. How it's connected with entropy, boy, that sounds string theory-ish, and that's sort of beyond my expertise. I'm not going to be able to say anything about that, much less try to make you feel warm and fuzzy about it. All right, so within the world of particle physics and within the world of physics, one of the biggest puzzles that's out there is what is it that does what the Higgs does in this Standard Model, which seems to work really well and describes every particle physics experiment that's been done for the last 70 years to a gnat's eyebrow. So if I take a beam of particles and I shoot it at a target and I get all sorts of crap coming out, the probability of which crap comes out at which angle, I can calculate perfectly within the context of this model. And the fundamental essence of the strong force, which holds protons and neutrons together, and basically the nuclei together, the weak force responsible for things like beta decay and neutrino interactions, and the electromagnetic force, all three are contained within this idea of the Standard Model. Okay, so it's a very fundamental sort of thing, and is the reason sort of behind why we're building the Large Hadron Collider. So let's see. So do we believe in the Standard Model? I mean, it came around in about the 1970s, had very particular predictions, and then the mid-early 1980s, in fact, these particles, the W and the Z that are predicted, specific properties and everything, the masses, the lifetimes, the charges, the angular distributions of particles that they would decay into, and the types of particles and the probabilities, all this stuff was exactly predicted in this quantum field theory model. And lo and behold, in early 1980s, these particles were actually seen at CERN in this experiment called UA1. That's a person right there. And these guys won the Nobel Prize for it. Okay. Let me come back to that. I know what I want to do. Okay, so let me try to summarize this picture of stuff for you a bit. But maybe I'll say one word before I do that. What we'd like to do is to understand the evolution of our universe. And the reason in terms, I mean, I'd like to do that in the context of this class because we know a lot about where how our universe evolved and how we got here, and that's one of the big things I'd like to talk to you about. But in terms of the multiverse theory, it turns out a number of different multiple universe ideas come out of cosmology. To understand cosmology, we basically have to understand the nature of forces and particles, and the reason why basically is the following. I'm going to show you next time, not today, evidence for why we believe the universe is expanding. But if you go back in time, effectively the universe becomes hotter and denser as you go back in time. If the universe is very, very hot, for example, then the typical energy that is in, of things interacting is not like what we see today. It is more like what we're seeing in accelerators. So the typical masses of the particles that exist, for example, might be very, very heavy. So the physical laws and the way things work and the types of things that are interacting will be very different in a hot and dense universe. Let's just take a simple thing. If I take a pot of gas and I heat it up to like 3,000 or 4,000 degrees, neutral atoms can't exist because that's enough energy that the atoms will hit each other and they'll knock the electrons off of them. So what you end up with is a gas of charged particles called a plasma. And that's just because of the way in which they interact. Well, so if we go back in time, at some point the universe was so hot, neutral atoms didn't exist. In fact, what was out there were protons and electrons and photons being emitted. As you go further back, things can become so energetic that in fact you can't have protons and neutrons exist, and we have something called quark-gluon plasma. And if you go further back, etc. So the kinds of stuff we've been talking about, we have to know about in trying to understand the phase transitions that the universe went through in the early stages, which we have to know in order to understand how we got here today. So that's why I'm dragging you through this quick laundry list of stuff so you sort of know it exists. Let me at least try to paint the picture a little bit, at least in summary here. If I can even write. Okay, so let's have the fundamental particles, the fundamental forces, and the relative strength of them. So of the fundamental forces that are out there, we believe there's gravitation. We believe there's the strong nuclear interaction. And we believe there's the weak nuclear interaction. And we believe there's electromagnetism. In this quantum exchange picture, the particle that gets exchanged for electromagnetism is the photon. The particle that gets exchanged for the weak interaction is either the W, which is charged, or the Z. The particle that gets exchanged for the strong force is called the gluon. And we don't actually have a quantum theory of gravity. I'm going to give you a different picture of gravity soon, which Einstein gave us in 1917, which is called general relativity. And it interprets gravity as a curvature in space-time, so I'll paint that for you next time. But right now, that's not to say people don't actually believe there should be a quantum picture of gravity. If there were, the particle that would get exchanged would be called, we've already named it, although we've never seen it, is called the graviton. Gravitation is extremely weak. It's 10 to the minus 40th or so times the strength of the strong interaction, I guess, depending on scale here, let's call this 30 and this 1 and this 1. So in terms of strengths, these three forces are all fairly strong. This one's extremely weak. It is a puzzle. You know, one of the puzzles in physics is physicists look for patterns and try to understand patterns should be natural. They shouldn't look completely bizarre and arbitrary in a sense. This looks pretty bizarre and arbitrary. You know, I'm going to, you know, let there be light, I'm going to have forces, this one will be strong, this one will, you know, they'll all be about this strength, but then this one's going to be 10 to the minus 40. It just makes no sense. So why is it that gravity is weak is one of the things people would like to understand. Of the fundamental particles in nature, we have three basic categories. We have quarks, of which we discovered six. And they have fractional charge. Quarks can combine into either three quark combinations, which are known as baryons. And so particles that you're familiar with are things like protons or neutrons. Or they can combine into quark and anti-quark. You always show an anti-particle by putting a line above it. And the most familiar particle there would be, these are called mesons, and something like the pion, and that's probably not familiar to you, but if you were to hear of one, that would be the one you'd probably hear about. Then there are particles called leptons, and there are six of those. There's the electron, the muon, and the tau, and these all are charged. They are basically the same, but the muon has more mass than the electron, and the tau has more mass than the muon. Why there are three, we don't know. And then each of these seems to be partnered with a type of neutrino. The electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino. And these have zero electric charge. And then finally we get the particles that are actually exchanged, which are called gauge bosons. And there we have the photon, the W and the Z, the gluon, and the graviton, if it exists. But we don't know of it existing yet. All of the particles have mass except the photon. So let's just start with leptons. Leptons do not have color charge, so they cannot feel the strong force, but they do feel, they have mass, so they can feel the gravitational force, they can feel the weak force, and they can feel the electromagnetic force. Quarks have electric charge, mass, and color force, color charge. So quarks should use a different color. Quarks feel gravitation, the strong force, the weak force, and the electromagnetic force. And so that what really distinguishes the quarks from the leptons has to do with the fact that these have color. And their masses are different. Another big puzzle we have is how these masses are what they are. The up and down quarks are fairly low mass, more than the electron, but not so much more. Excuse me. The top quark has a mass of 175 GeV, so it's about the mass of 175 protons, and yet it's a fundamental particle. All of these particles have different masses. We don't understand what the mass spectrum is. So I tell you that we have this model, the standard model, that really describes a lot of things that really work, and that's true, but it also leaves a lot of unanswered questions. One, we've never seen the Higgs. We just know something must do what the Higgs does. We don't know exactly why we have only six quarks and six leptons. We don't know what the mass spectrum really is in our theories. We don't have a prediction for that. These are all things that are probably telling us something very fundamental about nature, but we don't yet understand what it is. Yeah.
What are the Higgs bosons feel?
They all would feel gravity, actually. The photon actually, as we'll see in general relativity, also can actually feel gravity a little bit because it has energy. But this has charge and can feel the electromagnetic force. The photon basically is the electromagnetic force. It feels it can be exchanged. The Z is similar to the photon in that sense. The Z and the W feel the weak force. None of these feel the strong force except the gluon. They're sort of a mixed bag, which is why I didn't draw the arrows. But I think what's more important here is to realize that each of these mediate a particular force. So the photon mediates electromagnetism. These mediate the weak force. These mediates the strong force. Okay, so I'm not really expecting you to spout all this off on an exam. I want you to have seen it, seen the names, be aware that it exists, and I wanted to put the structure up for you. But it's a lot at once, and I'm not really expecting you to pull that away and recite it on an exam or something. I'll have to think a little bit about what my expectations would be on an exam where it's concerned, and I'll have to think about that a little bit over the next couple of days when I'm making out the recitation, and I'll try to make that consistent with sort of what I would expect you to know. Something like a gauge boson mediates the force might be something that would be, you know, what are the four forces of nature might be one. The fact that protons are made up of particles called quarks, that kind of thing I might ask. Okay, any questions on this? Yes?
What's a neutrino?
That's a good question. You could sort of think of it as a neutral but really, really light electron. It is a fermion. It's a fundamental particle. We know it exists in the following way. When people were first studying beta decay, they figured that beta decay, like we saw a minute ago, you could have a neutron going into a proton and an electron might come out. So you could have this nucleus and you could see these electrons coming out, and you could think of this process happening inside the nucleus, because in fact you could actually also see that the nuclear species would change into something that had, you know, one more proton. So beta decay was sort of understood in that way. But the thing is, if you have a two-body decay like this, then it actually has a very particular prediction as to what the energy of the electron will be coming out. Because basically the energy of this particle would have to be exactly the mass difference between the proton and the neutron. And basically you have to conserve momentum so it comes out back to back with the proton. But you can do basic mechanical momentum conservation equations, and what people would find is that they would expect to see, if you looked at the energy of the electron coming out in a beta decay, you would actually expect to see a sharp peak right at the calculated value you would expect based on the mass difference in these two particles. And this was known in the 1930s. And you would expect a little bit of width here because your detector wouldn't be able to measure the energy perfectly. But what they observed when they went and looked carefully at the electron's energy, they saw something that looked more like that, which is really different. And so people puzzled this, and a guy named Pauli, I think it was Wolfgang Pauli, he hypothesized an idea how this could happen. So what he was trying to do was to basically hold on to this, because we sort of knew that that was happening, but trying to account for this energy distribution. And what he found was this red distribution is exactly what you would expect to see if there were an additional particle that came out that carried away some of the energy. And the problem with this whole hypothesis is we don't see that particle. So you get this weird situation where literally this particle was hypothesized to account for the smeared out energy distribution, but we couldn't see it. So they did hypothesize the existence of a particle, which they called the neutrino, basically meaning small little something, because you can't see it, right? Basically, it does not interact readily with matter. Why? Because we don't see it. So that means it cannot have electric charge, because if it did, it would interact readily with matter. It cannot have a lot of mass, because if it did, the smearing would look different. So in fact, they thought it might even be massless. It took 20 years, but it was finally discovered in South Carolina at a place called the Savannah River Reactor. Because in nuclear reactors, you actually have nuclear processes happening that will generate lots of neutrinos. So they finally had a detector, and almost all of them will go right through matter because they don't interact readily with matter, which we now know is because they only interact via the weak interaction, which has an extraordinarily short range. But if you have enough neutrinos, you can actually see them. So, in fact, they were first seen in the 1950s. So neutrinos have been sort of fun particles. I'm sorry, you pressed the button. Neutrinos are what I do for my research. So I study beams of neutrinos. There's a fun history to neutrinos because they happen in all nuclear reactions, and we've already learned that the stars are powered by fusion reactions in the center of the stars. So amongst the particles that are produced in the center of stars are neutrinos. Now, lots of heat, lots of photons are also produced in the center of stars. The thing is, stars are opaque. So if you produce a photon or energy here in terms of photon in the center of a star, it can't go very far before it hits other things and scatters and gets absorbed. And so basically what happens with the photons is that energy takes forever to work its way out in the form of light. The photon basically scatters all over the place before it gets out. And I forget the number, but I mean it can be tens of thousands of years before that photon actually is emitted by the sun, or that energy that was the initial photon eventually, sort of, if you want to think of it that way, can work its way out. Neutrinos, on the other hand, don't interact readily with matter. So if I have a process creating neutrinos in the center of the sun right now, those neutrinos can come streaming through us 8 minutes later, because it takes that long for the speed of light from the center of the sun to reach us. Okay, so neutrinos are sort of cool in the sense that they give you X-ray vision into the center of the core of the sun. So there was a guy named Ray Davis who won a Nobel Prize just a few years ago, along with a guy named Kobayashi, who got his PhD here, by the way. They won the Nobel Prize just a few years ago for work in neutrino physics. Ray Davis built underground a big tank of chlorine, basically. A type of chlorine. And it turns out that within this big tank, neutrinos formed in the sun, electron neutrinos are basically what are formed in the sun if you look at the fusion processes. Those neutrinos go out in all directions, but amongst those directions, they're streaming through Earth everywhere all the time. So there's a flux of neutrinos from the sun constantly going through you, okay? And it just passes right through you for the most part. Same is true for this vat of liquid, cleaning fluid, basically, he had. I mean, we're talking a huge tank, you know, half the size of this room or something. And when those neutrinos pass through this stuff, occasionally, one of those neutrinos will actually hit a nucleus and cause basically inverse beta decay. You'll have a neutrino come in, be absorbed by the neutron and proton and turn into a neutron and actually change the nucleus into an argon nucleus. Argon's a gas which eventually bubbles up, and you can. So he had a technique where he would basically count the number of argon atoms produced in this big tank of chlorinated crud every day. And from this, he was able to infer how many electron neutrinos were coming from the sun at any given time. The puzzle comes in because we had a bunch of theorists who felt they understood the nuclear processes that were happening in the center of the sun. And they went through a bunch of calculations, and they figured out what are the processes that power stars in the center. They did the calculations, and from this they could calculate what we call the flux of neutrinos at Earth, the number of neutrinos per second that should be passing through Earth. And then Davis did the experiment, and he compared the experiment to what the theorist said, and he observed a third of the neutrinos passing through Earth relative to what the theorist thought should be there. And so most of us, at least by the time I learned about this, I just thought the theorists probably didn't know what they were doing. I mean, it seems sort of arrogant to think that you really know that well what's going on in the center of the sun, especially when there's the flux changes a lot with the temperature. I mean, to some 10 to the 25 power. So there's some really, you have to know things pretty well to get the flux just right. But it turns out the theorists really did know what they were doing. They were working, I mean, they were very confident in their numbers. So this was a huge puzzle. Turns out that we just discovered about 10 years ago, and this is how Kobayashi won the Nobel Prize, neutrinos can change from one type to another. They actually have a very tiny mass, and they do something called oscillation, which is a quantum mechanical effect. So if I start with one neutrino going along, it can actually change into other types of neutrinos. So it turns out that this happens. You start out with electron neutrinos in the center of the sun, and two-thirds of them basically change into other types of neutrinos by the time they get to Earth. We've now built experiments that are sensitive to the other types of neutrinos, and we now see that, in fact, we do see all the neutrinos that are coming from the sun. But, you know, there for a while it was like, okay, well, maybe the sun is broken. I mean, it would be a bad thing. So neutrinos have been very interesting. They continue to be interesting. I mean, we're trying to understand them. Right now, one of the big pushes that we're doing is that it could be that there is a difference between how neutrinos and antineutrinos interact in the universe in a very fundamental sense. And if this is true, it might be that neutrinos will hold the key as to why the universe is made of matter instead of antimatter. Because the universe is clearly made of matter, we believe there has to be some fundamental asymmetry between matter and antimatter that we're trying to get at. And it may be that it's in the neutrino sector. So this is sort of the biggest puzzle that Kevin McFarlane and Ari Bodek and I are currently working on in some experiments, one in Japan and one at Fermi Lab in Chicago. So, sorry, you pushed the button. We're out of time. Anything else? All right. Well, enjoy your weekend.